Okay, this morning we'll not be having a PowerPoint, and that's because I made the PowerPoint on Monday, and then I forgot to send it to the projector, so the guys in the back never got the PowerPoint, so we'll have to do without it. I don't know how we'll possibly be able to do so, even though for probably 2,000 years of church history they didn't have PowerPoints, so I think we'll be okay, right? We have been in the third division of our study of church history. This is our 50th lesson. So really, we've been in it for a while. You know, if we were doing it every week, we would have about a year's worth of church history classes that we've gone through, about 50 lessons. But it's taken longer because it's been spread out over a lot longer length of time because of other things being done in between. But we're in the period of the Reformation Church, the third major period, 1517. Usually it's dated from 1517 to 1648. And so far we've covered the Reformation in Germany. And then we looked at the Reformation in German-speaking Switzerland. And then the Reformation in French-speaking Switzerland. And then we looked at the radical Reformation in Europe. And now we are considering the Reformation in England. So that's where we pick up again today. And Again, I'm indebted for a lot of material here from Nick Needham and his books on church history. Also, Dave Merrick has excellent material on the history of the church that he does for RBS, and there are other good works. I intended to bring several books out here to show you, and I forgot to do that as well today. Sorry about that. All right, so we come back this morning to Unit 1 of the English Reformation, what I've been calling the dawn, the early dawn of the English Reformation. And I want to remind you of a few things from last time, that when it comes to the Reformation in England, there were two really powerful influences that were at work at the same time. First, there was the political element, the political influence, and that involved initially the dispute between Henry VIII and the papacy over his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and we'll learn more about that this morning. And then secondly, there was the spiritual influence. There was a real work of gospel reformation that began to take place in the hearts of men and women in England. So there were these two forces at work. God was powerfully at work spiritually in the hearts and minds of people leading up to and fueling the Reformation, while also in God's providence at the same time, there were things that were happening in the political realm in England that helped to facilitate England's break with the Roman Catholic Church, and eventually give Protestantism more room to develop. Well, as we consider the early dawn of the English Reformation, last time our focus was on the spiritual Reformation that began to occur in the hearts of some people in the early 1500s. And let me just review that briefly. There were a number of factors and influences that God used that fed this spiritual element of the beginning of the Reformation there. First, we saw that Lutheran books and ideas began to penetrate England, especially the capital city of London. And then there was already, you remember, a thriving underground Lollard movement, a group of people who were attached to the influence and teaching of Wycliffe some century and a half before that. There were still Lollards in London when Lutheran ideas began to come in who quickly embraced these ideas. And then thirdly, we saw that at Cambridge University, there were several humanist scholars who became attracted to Luther and his writings, and several of these young men were converted to a saving faith in Christ and began to embrace Reformation doctrine. We were introduced to Robert Barnes, Thomas Bilney, Thomas Cranmer, John Frith, and Hugh Latimer, all of which will eventually be burnt as martyrs for the Protestant faith. And then there was a fourth very important influence, and that was William Tyndale and his English translation of at least a large portion of the Bible. He did have the New Testament translated into English in some parts of the Old Testament, and he smuggled those books into England as he did his translation work in Europe. All right. But at the same time that these things were going on, in God's providence, a political reformation was beginning to happen. That was sometimes not at all driven by godly motives. And that's what we take up first of all this morning, the political reformation at the dawn of the Reformation in England. And that brings us to a very probably character you've heard of. Does anybody know who the main character is in the beginning of the political element of the Reformation in England? Yeah, Henry VIII. This political Reformation began under his reign. He's somewhat infamous. He reigned from 1509 to 1547. And more specifically, it began when he wanted to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon, because she had failed to give him a male heir to the throne, as though, of course, that was her fault. We know now, don't we, that it's the male who determines, it's the male's contribution to the conception of a child that determines the sex of the child, whether it's a male or a female. Well, anyway, Catherine had not given him a male heir. Now, Catherine was not childless. She had a daughter from Henry. She gave him a daughter. Her name was Mary Tudor. We're going to learn more about her later. She's the one known as Bloody Mary. But Catherine had not given Henry a son. And it was the thought at the time that it was not safe or proper for a woman to sit on the English throne. There was this great fear that without a son to succeed Henry, then England might plunge into a civil war. And England had just emerged from civil wars that were fought under Henry's father, Henry VII. I think they're called the War of the Roses, but it was wars over the rightful claimant to the throne, if I recall correctly. And this had just been previously in his father's reign. So Henry was concerned about that. And he also began to worry that perhaps his marriage to Catherine was cursed by God. And this was the reason he didn't have a son. And he feared this because Catherine had previously been the wife of Henry's brother, Arthur. Now, Arthur had died, and when Arthur died, Henry married Catherine. But Henry wondered if this was the curse of childlessness pronounced in the Old Testament civil law on a man who marries his brother's wife, based on Leviticus 20:21. If you want to look over there, Leviticus 20, verse 21, if a man takes his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. So Henry's thinking perhaps the reason his wife is not giving him a male heir is because this marriage is cursed by God. So in order to set aside Catherine... Oh, you guys did have it. Oh, okay. Okay, well, I thought I was losing my mind. And they were telling me they never got it, so... Yep, this is it. Good. Okay. All right. So Henry needed somehow to get out of this marriage, he thought, and he needed it to be dissolved or annulled by the Pope. But there was a problem. The Pope at that time, Pope Clement, was kind of obliged to, for various reasons, and under the power of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. In fact, Charles's troops had, in kind of a rebellion, had recently sacked Rome. Now, do you remember who Charles V is? He's the Holy Roman Emperor. He's the same guy that Luther stood before at the Diet of Worms when he made his famous confession, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Well, Clement was afraid of Charles, and guess what? Charles was Catherine's nephew. Remember, Catherine is the lady he's married to right now. And Charles was not about to let his aunt be treated this way, so Pope Clement refused to grant the annulment. Well, this began to push Henry toward the idea of breaking the connection between the English church and the papacy, which he eventually did. And here was the process by which he did that. First, Henry tried to obtain the divorce by diplomacy. He sent a negotiator, Cardinal Wolsey, there, but it really didn't work. That failed. And secondly, from 1529 to 1531, Henry tried to secure a divorce by putting pressure on Clement. And doing that, the way he tried to do that was by tightening his grip on the English church and prompting then the English clergy to appeal to the Pope to do something about it and to grant the divorce. But that too failed. And then Henry took his most drastic step. From 1532 to 1534, he began a process of moving towards separation from the Roman Church, separating the English Church from papal jurisdiction. And this was something of a process that took place with the help of the Parliament, which Henry summoned in 1529. And there were a number of important acts of legislation that were passed by the Parliament. The first of all, the Church, I have these here, the Church in England lost its legislative independence from the English Crown by the law passed that was entitled Submission to the Clergy. This stripped the English Reformed Roman Catholic Church of its right to make laws without the consent of the Parliament. Second, also in 1532, the Parliament passed an act diverting clerical taxes paid to Rome to the English Crown. Now, originally this was a temporary measure pending the success of the divorce, but in the following year it was made permanent, and it was followed by the Dispensations Act, which stopped all payments to Rome. Thirdly, in 1533, the Parliament passed the Act in Restraint of Appeals, and the idea is restraining appeals to Rome. And that act deprived the papacy of any right to judge English cases in either church or state. And then fourthly and finally, there in 1534, they passed the Act of Supremacy, in which Henry, or the English Crown, was declared the head of the Church of England rather than the Pope. Well, the vast majority of the bishops and clergy submitted to Henry's parliamentary revolution, and those who didn't and remained loyal to Rome, at least admittedly so, they were executed. So at this point, politically speaking, at least, the English Church had separated itself from the Roman Catholic Church and from the jurisdiction of the Pope. But let me say here, it's very important that we understand that Henry, though he had broken the English Church's ties with Rome, were not to think that Henry had become a true Christian or that his doctrines had substantially changed, because they had not. We're not to think at this point that most of the people doctrines had changed, really. This was a political move on Henry's part more than anything else. Henry had no desire to adopt a full-blown Lutheran or Zwinglian or Calvinistic theology. And he's going to persecute Protestants who refuse to toe his line, as well as obstinate Romanists. But politically speaking, God, as he works even in the hearts of wicked rulers, this did open the door for the spiritual reformation that was already beginning to occur in England to make more progress in the period that then fought, this period that this that that entire decade from 1530 to 1540. And that occurred primarily through the influence of two key men, both with the first name Thomas. Thomas Cranmer. You may have heard of Thomas Cranmer. Cranmer will become one of the truly great men in English church history. We'll learn more about him, God willing, later. But he was a gentle scholar. He was kind of a very careful, cautious thinker who tended to move very slowly. But he was beginning to move slowly in the direction of Protestantism. And he was a man who supported Henry's case for divorce. He became one of Henry's favorites. In fact, it's been said that Cranmer became perhaps the only man Henry ever trusted. He believed that Cranmer really cared about him. He actually believed Cranmer really actually loved him. And he trusted Cranmer, and he rewarded him by making him the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1533. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury is the highest position in the English Church, next to the crown. Well, Cranmer pronounced Henry's marriage to Catherine null and void on the idea that it violated Leviticus 20:21, which I think is very debatable, more than even debatable. I don't think it really applied. But anyhow, he declared it null and void. And then Henry's new marriage, anybody know who his second wife was? Anybody know that? You've probably heard her name. Oh, come on, is it up there? No. Oh, all right. Yeah, all right. And you still couldn't get it. Anne of Boleyn, right. So he pronounced Henry's new marriage to Anne Boleyn, a lady of the court, as lawful in June 1534. Well, at that point, Pope Clement excommunicated Henry. And in September, and gave birth, but not to the desired male heir. She gave birth to a daughter. Anybody know what her name was? It's not up there. Why not? Because she's a pretty important figure in history. Nope. Elizabeth. Mary was the daughter of Catherine in Henry's first marriage, and that's going to be significant later. Yeah, so she gave birth to Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth will eventually rule England for 44 years, but before she comes along, you have Edward and Mary, and we'll talk more about them in a moment. So I also have more to say about Thomas Cranmer later. The second Thomas Cromwell. Now, he's not to be confused with Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell is a later very important figure in English history, a soldier and statesman, but he lived in the 17th century. So this is not Oliver Cromwell, this is Thomas Cromwell. Oliver was, I think, the great-grandson of Thomas's sister who kept the Cromwell name. So this is Thomas. Who was Thomas Cromwell? Well, he became Henry's prime minister in 1534, and Henry gave this post to him as a reward for the fact that he was very influential in guiding through the Parliament all of those legislations that we looked at earlier and helped England to become independent of the papacy. And so Henry made Cromwell his prime minister. Now, Cromwell had strong personal leanings toward Protestantism, and he sought to encourage Protestants as far as he could. And I say as far as he could, because remember, Henry still held to traditional Roman Catholic beliefs, though he rejected the papacy. Well, 1536 to 1540, Cromwell oversaw what is kind of officially called the suppression of the monasteries throughout England. It was actually the dissolution of monasteries, or the getting rid of all the monasteries in England. And one of the ways he prepared for that, in preparation for that, Cromwell and his staff, they compiled a comprehensive register of the English church's wealth. And in doing that, it revealed that the income of the monasteries was 3 to 4 times greater than the income of the crown. Well, as the monasteries were suppressed during a 4-year period, most of the monks were given a pension and a parish appointment, while all of the property was taken over of the monasteries, was taken over by the monarchy, and then it was sold to the English nobility. And as Needham comments, nothing less than an economic revolution, a redistribution of land and wealth on a scale unsurpassed in English history. Well, the suppression and the disappearance of monasticism in England was a severe psychological blow against Roman Catholicism. Cromwell was also very instrumental in promoting the English Bible when he was prime minister. He and Cranmer urged the English clergy to appeal to Henry for an official English translation of the scriptures. And in 1539, Miles Coverdale published the first complete, and I say complete, remember, Tyndale's didn't cover the whole Bible. Miles Coverdale published a complete English Bible. And Henry also sanctioned a London printing of Coverdale's Bible and also a different translation by John Rogers called Matthew's Bible. Well, in 1538, acting as Henry's vice regent, Cromwell commanded every parish church in England to obtain an English Bible for all to read or to have read to them. And I'm not sure, but if I recall correctly, I believe what they would do is they would put the Bible in the churches, and it was chained to something so you couldn't take it out. And that doesn't mean common people didn't have Bibles, that they couldn't purchase Bibles or get their hands on Bibles, whether it be Tyndale's or the others. But they didn't want this Bible to be stolen. They wanted every church to at least have an English Bible in it, where people perhaps that didn't have Bibles could come to the, we would say, church building, and they could read the Bible. And there was an English Bible there also to be read to the people when they gathered to worship. So Cromwell was moving was helping to move things more in the Protestant direction. He eventually fell politically in 1540 for various political reasons and actually was executed. A lot of people were executed back then. But he did a lot to move England in a more Protestant direction. Now, the dissolution of the monasteries was followed by a more general growth in Protestant views, especially in London and in the rest of the southern part of England. It was being very much impacted as well, much more than the northern part at that time. The 1530s saw the rise of a number of evangelical bishops in the church. There were seven of them, to be exact. There's Cranmer, who I've already mentioned, and there were others whose names you've probably never heard, but some were more political figures. One of them, though, Hugh Latimer, which we've mentioned before, was a very, very powerful preacher. He's known as probably the most powerful preacher in the 16th century, English preacher, most used of God, and we'll talk more about him again later. The promotion of the English Bible also led to a huge growth of Bible reading, as you might imagine, among the lay people. Now listen as I quote directly from Needham. Ordinary people were discussing the Bible in alehouses. The illiterate learned to read so that they could study Scripture. Women dared to argue with priests about what the Bible taught. By 1537, Edward Fox could say to his fellow bishops, "Make not yourselves the laughingstock of the world. Light is sprung up and is scattering all the clouds. The lay people know the Scriptures better than many of us." So by the time of Henry's death in 1547, Protestantism had become firmly established in at least the southern part of England, though there were still many common people and many scholars, especially at Oxford, who were still devoted to the old Roman Catholic religions. Oxford remained kind of a bastion of Roman Catholicism for a long time. And then we also have to remember that Henry himself never really became a Protestant in the spiritual and doctrinal sense. In fact, in 1539, he decreed a new test of orthodoxy called the Six Articles. And those articles affirmed transubstantiation, a celibate priesthood, and a number of other Roman Catholic doctrines. And some of you may know that Henry actually wrote a treatise attacking Martin Luther. And of course, he was not a match for Martin Luther when it came to the Bible or when it came to theology. So he didn't really come out looking too well in that. But he attempted to correct Martin Luther. So he kind of dabbled in theological writing at a certain point as well. But here's kind of the summary. Reformation was at least beginning, both politically, and in many hearts it was happening spiritually, but there was still a long way to go when Henry died, and he was replaced by his 9-year-old son. I was thinking about that, same age as Garrison. I think Garrison sometimes would like to be king, but he's not. His 9-year-old son, Henry Edward VI. And so we move now from the dawning of the English Reformation to consider what I'm calling the gradual progress and the temporary setback of the Reformation during the reigns of Edward VI and Bloody Mary. Now, you remember that Edward desired to have a male heir to the throne. Catherine, his first wife, didn't accomplish that. She gave him a daughter named Mary. Anne Boleyn, she had a daughter named Elizabeth. But his third wife, Jane Seymour, finally gave him a son, Edward. And because he was the only male heir, when Henry died, Edward succeeded to the throne. He was only 9 years old, as I said. However, it's interesting that because Henry seems kind of sensed the direction that things were going in England at the time, he made certain that Edward was raised by Protestant tutors. And so as a young boy, he was taught the Protestant faith, and as he grew, became older in his early years and teens, he was sincerely and earnestly devoted to the Protestant faith. And there's a lot of indications that he was probably a genuine and true believer. So when we come to Edward, we kind of have the political and the spiritual reformations kind of coming closer together into closer harmony. Now, by this time, Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he had fully embraced Calvinistic Protestantism by this point. And since Edward was only 9 when he became king, 2 nobles were appointed to kind of rule on his behalf. And both of them were Protestants, the Duke of Somerset and the Duke of Northumberland. And under Somerset, Northumberland, and Cranmer, and other leading reformers, the Anglican Church was gradually transformed into a Protestant body. There were three very influential co-workers with Cranmer in the reforming of the church. It was Hugh Latimer, who by this time is now Bishop of Worcester. You've already heard of him. Nicholas Ridley, and have you ever heard of Nicholas Ridley? There have been some good modern books written about him. He was the Bishop of Rochester and then the Bishop of London. And then there was John Hooper, who was Bishop of Gloucester. Latimer became, at this time under Edward, became a court preacher, which means he would preach in the court to Edward and to the courtiers. And he was also engaged in extensive itinerant evangelism, traveling about and preaching the gospel. And again, as I said, he's often referred to as the greatest English preacher of the 16th century. Ridley was perhaps the greatest theologian among these early English reformers. And Hooper, his influence is interesting because he had at one time had been in exile in Europe, on the continent, in some of the really strong, well-established, well-organized Reformed churches there in Strasbourg. He was in Basel. He was in Zurich, where Zwingli was. So he had been exposed there to churches that were more thoroughly Reformed. And so when he came back to England, he had a real zeal to want to see the English church thoroughly Reformed, to see all vestiges of Romanism to be purged from the church. And therefore, he's sometimes been referred to as kind of the forerunner of the Puritans who will come along in the next generation. Now, something else that occurred during the brief reign of Edwards is there was an influx of distinguished Protestant refugees from the continent who came into England. Now, what was going on in Europe at this time? There was war. Charles V was seeking to stamp out Protestants. You had nations that embraced politically Protestantism, others Roman Catholic, and there was war that was happening, being waged by Charles V on the Protestants. And so some fled Europe and came to England, and some of them were great scholars and preachers who had been mightily used in the Reformation on the continent. Some men that we studied some time ago, perhaps you'll at least remember their names. A couple of you may remember is Martin Bucer and then also Peter Martyr. Well, these men helped to bring a strong dose of Reformed thinking into the English church. In fact, Bucer will work together with Cranmer in preparing the second edition of the Book of Common Prayer, which we'll learn about in a moment. And then Peter Martyr obtained a position, a post as a lecturer in theology at Oxford. And you remember Oxford was the majority of the teachers there and the students were sympathetic to Romanism. So he had a rough time there, but he lectured in theology at Oxford. So there continued to be this gradual reformation in the English church. It was developing really in a way that was unique to England. It wasn't entirely Lutheran or entirely Reformed at this time. The church under Edward had more of a kind of Lutheran perspective or attitude toward church government, which would include state control of the church through the king or the parliament or through royally appointed bishops. But then this was combined with more Reformed perspectives on other doctrinal issues, such as what we would call the doctrines of grace, and also including the Lord's Supper. Now, in the realm of public worship under Henry's reign, there was a massive wave of government-sponsored iconoclasm. What is that? Well, that's the rejection and the destruction of icons, religious images. And this wave of iconoclasm, it involved images of the saints in the churches. They were removed or they were destroyed, and church walls were whitewashed to cover over any paintings of saints or of Christ or anything like that that were on the walls. And you can go to old churches there in England and still see evidence of that. There's a church we went to in Ely, and you go in there and there's these statues on the walls and their faces have been defaced, they've been broken up, and that goes all the way back to the English Reformation when they went and destroyed all of the icons in the churches. And also stone altars were replaced by wooden tables. And Cranmer produced a service book for use in worship called the Book of common prayer. And this is a book that gradually really gained overwhelming affectionate acceptance by generations of Anglican worshipers, really all the way up until the 20th century, until the middle of the 20th century, roughly. Now, the first edition of it was a bit more cautious. It wasn't as demonstrative. It wasn't as definitely Protestant. But the second edition, this is the one that Bucer worked together with Cranmer, and by this time Cranmer had developed as well further in his views of doctrine. It was more thoroughly Protestant. And if you've ever looked at a copy of the Book of Common Prayer, it's really very edifying to read. It contains prayers and scripture readings for public worship occasions. And also, in the way Cranmer did this, he incorporated into the churches the older practice that you have in the early church, which had mostly been lost in the Middle Ages, of vocal participation by the laity in worship, kind of like what we do on Sunday evenings when we recite sections of our confession of faith, or when we actually sing together hymns that have been pre-composed. Well, he introduced this type of thing into the English church. So these are some of the advancements that occurred under the reign of Edward VI. However, Edward was a very sickly young man. He only reigned for 6 years. And he died of tuberculosis as a teenager in 1553. And next in line to the throne was his older sister, Mary. Now, you can almost tell by the picture I'm going to show over that she probably wasn't a very nice person. Now, I don't know if that's because, you know, the artist is kind of biased, and so he painted her in a little different way. I don't know, but... Now, Mary, you remember who she was? She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, okay? Henry's first wife that Henry divorced. So, it's believed, you know, she came to the throne already with a degree of bitterness toward the way her mother had been treated, and she was also a very zealous Roman Catholic, as her mother had been. And her reign has come down to us in history as one of the most persecuting, violent reigns in the history of the Christian church. She's known for her persecution of Protestants and her attempt to reestablish the Roman Catholic Church in England. Now, there was an attempt before Edward died, because all of those in the, you know, higher echelons of the political structure of that time feared what might be coming if Mary becomes queen. And so there was an effort to exclude her from the throne that was strongly supported by Edward himself. There was a daughter-in-law to the Duke of Northumberland, and her name was Jane Grey. And there's a very excellent biography of her. I think it's written by Faith Cook. We may even have it in our bookstore to read about Jane Grey. She was a remarkable young lady who was a genuine, devoted Christian, and she was fourth in line to the throne. And Ridley supported this scheme to put Jane Grey on the throne. Cranmer also cooperated with it, but the plot failed, and she was only queen for 9 days. You may have heard of the 9 days queen. That was Jane Grey. And then when Mary established in her claim to the throne of England, well, Northumberland tried to escape Mary's wrath by suddenly converting to Roman Catholicism, but she executed him nonetheless. Jane Grey was murdered as a convinced Protestant. It's amazing to read as they're trying to get her to recant. This is all recorded. Her expressions of doctrine and of the Christian faith and of her strong adherence to the doctrine of justification by faith. And you read that and you think, that's like a 16-year-old girl who knew the Word of God that well and was that confident in her understanding of the Christian faith. It's really moving. Well, Mary proceeded to bring the English church back under the papacy, and she restored the traditional Roman Catholic worship in Latin. She also married King Philip, the King of Spain, the most deadly foe of Protestantism in Europe. Well, at this time, many Protestants fled the country and went to the continent. There were others who remained, and in 1555, the bloodbath began. Between 1555 and 1558, some 300 English Protestants were burnt at the stake. Another 100 died of maltreatment in prison. Most of these were ordinary Christians. They weren't famous leaders or anything like that, which really reveals how deeply at that time the Protestant faith was beginning to be rooted into the grassroots hearts of the people of England. However, some of the martyrs were famous Protestant leaders and ministers, and this included Cranmer, Ridley, Latimer, and Hooper, whom I mentioned earlier. Latimer and Ridley were actually burned together at Oxford, and it was on that occasion that Latimer made his famous remark, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man, for we shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." There's actually a book entitled Such a Candle, which is about Latimer and Ridley and also their martyrdom. Martyrdom of Thomas Cranmer. It's very interesting. He was subjected to really unceasing psychological pressure to recant, and he eventually gave in, partly because of a high view he had of the monarchy and so forth, but partly because he gave in to fear, and he recanted. However, in spite of this, Mary decided to make an example out of him anyway, and to burn him anyway, as the foremost leader of the Anglican Reformation. But when he was brought to the place of execution at Oxford, Cranmer unexpectedly refused to read out his recantation. Instead, to everyone's shock and surprise, he vigorously defended the Protestant faith, confessing and blaming himself for his cowardice in ever having denounced it, and he denounced the Pope as Antichrist. And so he was burned. And one of the things interesting about his death is he held out the hand which had signed the document of recantation and put it into the fire to be the first part of his body. Now, anybody ever heard of this book? Well, these martyrdoms were very soon after this recorded in great detail by John Fox. If you haven't ever read read that book, it's very, very moving to read. Almost immediately after Mary's death in 1559, he published his accounts in Latin. Then he published an enlarged edition in English, 1563. This enlarged edition chronicled the martyrdoms under Mary, but it also weaved into it the larger story of all Christian martyrdoms from the early church onward, in which he seeks to show, as the great persecutor, first pagan Rome and then papal Rome. And this book was a huge success throughout England. Very influential. It was published right after Mary died, and in 1571, the Anglican governing body ordered that copies of Fox's Book of Martyrs should be lodged in all cathedrals for the public to read. So in every cathedral, you had a Bible that was authorized by the state to be placed in the church, an English Bible, and you had a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs. And as Needham comments, Fox had ensured that for centuries the majority of England's inhabitants would look on Roman Catholicism as an inherently cruel and intolerant religion that was hostile to the lives and liberties of the English people. And even before Fox's book, while all of these burnings were still happening under Mary, it caused a great feeling of revulsion among many of the English people, and so she was given by them the nickname that we've all heard of, Bloody Mary. And many of the English people also resented her marriage to Philip, the King of Spain, as it seemed to place England under Spanish domination. And so there were a number of plots to try to overthrow Mary. All of them failed. But by the time she died in November of 1558, there had developed in England a widespread hatred of Roman Catholicism. And that will bring us now to the long reign of Elizabeth, and what has been called the Elizabethan settlement. And that will have to wait until next time. A couple of just practical things to say here. We learn, as we study these things, how God works even through ungodly rulers. And we're reminded of the proverb that says, "The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it whichever way he will." And so sometimes God can use ungodly rulers. Henry VIII was an ungodly man. And yet, driven by his own lust and his own desire for power, God overruled those things in ways politically that actually paved the way and opened the way for a greater expansion of the Protestant faith in England. And it's good for us to remember that, that we can sometimes be thankful for legislations that are passed, even though we don't necessarily approve of the life or the lifestyle of those who pass them. And how God can do that and has done that throughout history. We saw that in our reading of Isaiah recently in the evenings, how Cyrus of Persia, who himself was an ungodly pagan, yet God used him to deliver the exiled Israelites from Babylonian captivity and to allow them to return to their land. The second thing, we ought to learn from these things to value the tremendous heritage that we have as Reformed Christians. And I hope that's been the case all through our studies of church history, and to appreciate the price that many people have paid for us to enjoy the liberties and the freedoms and the truths that we profess and hold dear, to be able to do so without fear. It's sad to see a whole culture that's forgotten its history. And that's the case in England, and it's increasingly the case here in America. And people use the freedoms and liberties that they have that were paid for by the blood of people like this to rail against those very liberties and freedoms. And sometimes it's rooted in just wickedness and also just ignorance. Very few, even in our own culture, really understand very much about our own history or about the history of the influence of the Christian church in positive ways in culture and life. So we should learn from this to value our heritage and be committed to the truth. Their faithfulness unto death ought to inspire us to the same faithfulness, as the writer of Proverbs says in Proverbs 23:23. This should always be our demeanor. Buy the truth. Buy the truth and sell it not. Expend energy. Expend everything you have to buy the truth and to know the truth. And having gained the truth, whatever you do, don't ever sell it, whatever it costs. And so may we be inspired by these men. All right, time for us to go. Let's pray together.